This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. Many countries are breathing a sigh of relief for having come through an infectious disease pandemic. That's, of course, COVID-19. But this is no time for anyone to pause because the world has been backsliding when it comes to the HIV pandemic, with progress reducing HIV cases, slowing down amid COVID-19 and other global crises that we have been facing. Joining me to discuss what exactly is happening on the HIV front, Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society and also infectious diseases physician at University Malaya Medical Center. She's just back from Montreal, where the International AIDS Conference happened, where the UN AIDS Global AIDS Update 2022 report was launched. So we want to get her insights on what were some of the findings there and how Malaysia is faring as well. So do call us if you have any questions or thoughts you'd like to share. 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Prof. Adiba, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Sharik. Thank you for having me. And just getting over my jet lag.
That's right. Very, very long way to travel. But by the looks of the tweets that I was reading coming out of the conference, it was really lots of robust discussions. Could you share some highlights from those few days there? And, maybe some reflections as well from your 2-year term.
Thank you, Sharik, once again. Well, it was really an honor and privilege for me to co-chair this International AIDS Conference, the 24th International AIDS Conference in Montreal. Of course, it wasn't without some controversies around the visa issues, but it was the first time that we've come together since COVID-19, and I think everyone was really excited to be together. And we chose the theme of the conference as re-engage and follow the signs. And I think I can proudly say that we were successful in doing that. There was a lot of science presented despite, the COVID pandemic, and a lot of global interest, I think, from the news that came out. So some of the highlights before the conference started. So 2 days before the conference started, UNAIDS released its annual report, and which it rightly called in danger. And the reason for that is, as you alluded to, the world has made tremendous progress in bringing the number of new infections down compared to 2-3 decades ago, thanks to advances in treatment and thanks to advances in pre-exposure prophylaxis and other prevention methods. However, in the last year, overall, there's been the decline, general global decline, is not as fast as it used to be the years preceding COVID-19. And more worryingly is that we are seeing increases in new HIV infections in a number of regions, particularly Central Asia and Eastern Europe, Latin America, as well as Middle East and North Africa, and certain countries in Asia. So, given that we have this very effective treatment that can reduce onward transmission of HIV, and we have these effective prevention programs, this is somewhat concerning. So the global target that the world wanted to see of new HIV infections for 2021 was 1.5 million new infections, which was a target that everyone agreed to. 500 new HIV infections. Unfortunately, we saw 1.5 new infections according to this report. So 1 million more than what we should have.
So the target was 500,000 new infections.
Yeah.
What actually happened was 1.5 million. So 1 million over target.
Correct. Correct. And remember, we've set ourselves a goal of ending AIDS by 2030 as a public health threat. So meaning we're off target. I mean, even before COVID, we were not quite going to achieve that goal. But now, you know, we've slowed down even further. And, you know, some startling figures like 650,000 people died of AIDS in 2021, which once again shouldn't be the case because there's effective treatment. 49% of the infection was seen in young girls and women. This is more specific to sub-Saharan Africa, whereas in our region, what we're seeing is 70% or more of infections are among what we term key populations. So men who have sex with men, sex workers, transgenders, people in incarcerated settings, and partners of all these people. So those were some of the startling figures. Yeah.
And how is
4,000 people become infected with HIV. Sorry to interrupt. 4,000 people become infected with HIV every day. Yeah.
And that's shocking, like you said, right? We already have the science. We've put them into practice and we've seen that it can be so dramatic in its reduction. And yet these numbers are there. We'll get into why in a little bit. But in all those numbers, how's Malaysia doing?
Yeah, Malaysia, after the success of harm reduction in bringing down a number of new infections amongst people who inject drugs, unfortunately, what we're seeing now is an increase once again. I think we had something like 3,500 new infections last year, or maybe slightly more than that. And like many countries in the region, the people we are seeing coming with new infections are amongst young people, gay men and others. So we have got some work to do.
To cut a long story short, then the question is, why are we backsliding?
Well, I think one of the reasons, undoubtedly, COVID-19, proved to be barriers to people coming forward for testing. You know, people were afraid to go to hospitals for fear of getting COVID. Programs became disrupted. So that's one. But like I said, even before COVID, we were already slowing down in terms of the response. And I think partly, attention has shifted to other conditions, including COVID. And there's that inherent in our country and countries, in conservative settings, that the inherent sort of barriers that we see towards really implementing these effective programs, whether it's treatment or prevention, to its full scale, right? For instance, treatment, we should be aiming for 95% of people who are living with HIV know their HIV status, 95% are on treatment, 95% have undetectable viral levels, but we're not there. We are, I think, something like 80, 60 and 80, thereabouts. But countries like Botswana, one of the big stories in Montreal was, of course, Botswana, which has a population prevalence of HIV of 20%. It's a country with one of the highest rates of HIV infection. So one in five person living in Botswana, or one in five Botswanans, is living with HIV, yet they've been able to achieve the 95-95 goals. Similarly, there are other success stories like Rwanda and Swatini. No doubt they are getting a lot of financial and technical support from PEPFAR, the US President Special Program for HIV AIDS and Global Fund, but you know, they have a less robust health system, right? So what I'm trying to say is it can be done with political will, with money, with coming together, with mobilizing community workers, because these are the secrets of the success of countries that have achieved 95, including those around us like Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam, have not quite achieved 95, but you know, doing well.
All right. You've listed out a few things, funding, community-driven services and support, which I want to tease out a little bit more when we come back from the break. I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society, about the world's progress in reducing HIV, in ending AIDS, why we are sort of losing momentum, partly due to the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. But, you know, we've been seeing slowing down even before COVID-19 came into the picture as well. And we want to make sure that we keep our finger on the pulse there. We're also looking a little bit at how Malaysia is doing. Do WhatsApp us with questions or thoughts, 018-789-8899, or call us 03-7733-2900. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my guest, Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society. She's just back from Montreal, where the 24th International AIDS Conference has just taken place. At the same time, the UN AIDS also launched its Global AIDS Update 2022 report, titled very aptly, as Prof. Adiba has said, In Danger, which is to say that we are all in danger if we don't arrest if we don't arrest the reduction or the slowing down of the progress that we've been making in terms of ending AIDS and reducing HIV. Prof. Adiba has given us a snapshot of these findings in the report globally, as well as in Malaysia and within our region, looking at some countries that have actually been doing well despite what the prognosis may look like. And, you know, you talked about Botswana and some of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, which granted they may be getting more funding due to circumstances. But Prof, I think overall the bigger picture is that resources are shrinking. And I think in Malaysia, correct me if I'm wrong, the second week came in with the second lowest proportion of HIV prevention spending out of total HIV expenditure. What does that actually mean for the way we are approaching HIV?
Well, that's the thing, you see. First of all, we need to invest in prevention, because the thing with HIV is, thankfully, there's effective treatment that can, you know, essentially if someone is diagnosed early, they could lead a normal, healthy life and have a normal lifespan. So you're going to have to support treatment for the rest of their life, which could be up to 70 years or so, similar to that of a Malaysian male or female who is not living with HIV. So that's number one. It will just increase your healthcare costs. But at the same time, you can't sort of say, all right, I'm going to take more money out of treatment to put into prevention, because treatment is also prevention. By treating someone living with HIV, not only will you ensure that they lead a good, healthy life, but if they have their virus down to what we call undetectable level, they will not transmit to their sexual partners, even in sexual acts without condoms, in a concept that we call undetectable equals untransmissible. And we know that by doing this, that's why the third goal in the 95 is to ensure that you reach 95% of people who are on treatment have undetectable viral levels, so that they don't transmit forward. And as a public health prevention, you know, strategy. So we need to do both. We need to provide treatment, of course, for people who are living with HIV, but we also need to expand our prevention efforts.
I mean, we don't want to take money away from treatment because it doesn't work that way. They're not isolated. But then do we take money from somewhere else then? I was reading that even the UNAIDS executive director herself said that the investment in ending AIDS is actually the same investment that protects us from other pandemics. So actually, it's not a zero-sum game then. It's not like I'm taking away someone else's piece of the pie, is it?
Absolutely. And you know what? Actually, a lot of the success that we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic came from the back of the advances in HIV science, including the vaccines, including the platforms that allowed for the large vaccine trials to occur, including the surveillance for new variants. So the bottom line is we need to invest in health and we need to invest in scientific research. And it's not, like you said, zero-sum game, choosing one over the other. It may be that, you know, it's not within, you know, you're choosing one disease over the other, but maybe choosing health above buying ships, warships.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more there. And, you know, you can see the results when you spend in health.
Absolutely. And you can see the results when you don't spend in health vis-a-vis COVID-19. I mean, that nothing could have been more dramatic, right, than the COVID-19 pandemic. And you know that if we're not prepared and if we don't prepare for the next pandemic, unfortunately, everyone says it's going to happen again, right? Another pandemic will hit us, hopefully not in my rest of my lifetime, but so it is about investment in health, full stop.
How about investment in our communities? And I think you had alluded to, let's say, Botswana as a success, one of the success stories, and that community action played a role there. And I know that community and civil society organizations here in Malaysia also are so strong in the way they... Yeah, can you talk a little bit? Yeah.
And I think this is, again, a legacy of the HIV pandemic, the legacy of the HIV response, that community has and has always played a very strong role, whether it was the activism that eventually saw the US investing in treatment research and ensuring that, you know, once treatment was discovered, that people in sub-Saharan Africa were not left behind. It took many years, but eventually through advocacy and activism that came about. But one of the highlights of the HIV response is the importance that communities play in educating, creating awareness amongst peers, in delivering services. And you can see examples of that here in Malaysia. The needle syringe program was delivered by community workers of people who inject drugs or people who previously inject drugs. Same with transgender programs, sex work programs. It's key, in fact, that they are involved in the response. And really, specialists like me should only, you know, come in when patients are sick. But in terms of prevention, early work prevention, all that can be very effectively done by community workers. But they have to be well compensated, organized, accredited, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the HIV world has provided an excellent example. One of the things in the meeting that we had in Montreal was a pre-conference with the Non-Communicable Disease Alliance. And, you know, and they wanted to see how these two worlds can integrate, but also how the non-communicable disease sector can learn from the HIV sector in terms of getting getting the communities involved, not just doctors, not just healthcare workers. A very distinct and unique feature of the AIDS conference that I'm very proud about is we have something called the Global Village, where we bring youth leaders, community leaders, activists, and you know, in a huge space and stalls, and you know, to share experience, to showcase their work, etc. You'll never see this happening in a cardiology conference, I can tell you that. It's all men in suits.
So go HIV community, go grassroots organizations.
Absolutely.
But are there any new challenges perhaps, or perhaps existing challenges that they are facing? Because if they can't do their work, really everything kind of fails, doesn't it? So what are some challenges they are facing?
Yeah, I think one of the highlights that was brought about during the conference in Montreal also is how much inequalities play into the HIV response, whether it's access to healthcare, whether it's access to knowledge. Of course, in the US, it's around people, whether they have insurance and all that, and also the racial inequalities, et cetera, et cetera. There was a very nice study showing how communities with larger Black populations were less likely to receive pre-exposure prophylaxis versus those in white communities, for example. So inequalities in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, the inequalities is around women and girls, you know, the power dynamics there. So inequality was very much discussed in Montreal. And the other thing is, of course, the criminalization of same-sex behavior, criminalization of sex work, criminalization of people who inject drugs. This is the root of many things, you know, the root of the stigma and discrimination that's still pervasive, even in healthcare settings, the root of people not wanting to come forward to seek, you know, medical knowledge and prevention and treatment for fear of being arrested for because of shame. And so, yeah, so there are many structural problems like laws and policies that impede us really, really implementing what is now, you know, great science that's given us fantastic treatment and prevention. But the you know, the hurdles are still there because of these barriers.
Mm. The hurdles are significant as well, really, really
Absolutely.
Massive.
Mm-hmm.
Can you paint us a picture of what's the reality? Let's say for the 1.5 million people newly infected in 2021, already 1 million more than should have been. That's not to say the 500,000, you know, should have been infected anyway. Millions of others living with HIV currently as well. And you said there should be no deaths of AIDS. You know, we already have treatment, we have pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means you can prevent it. But with all this science, what is still the reality on a day-to-day basis for many of these 1.5 million people, for instance?
Of those who are living with infection. Yet, and sadly, it depends on where you live, right? If you have just been diagnosed with HIV and you're living in the UK or in the US, perhaps not the US, not a good example, but in the UK where you have access to free treatment, or if you're in Europe and all that. But in Malaysia, the government has been giving free treatment. We should be proud of this, that Malaysia, 97% or 97% of our funding for both prevention and treatment has come from domestic funding. That's partly because we're too rich to qualify for, you know, all the global fund, etc., in sort of international standards. So what it means, yeah, but there are also in some countries where you know, you're not provided free treatment, so you have to cough up the money to access treatment. So that's one, just pure access to effective treatment. Number two, again, in Malaysia, although free treatment is available, I and my colleagues at UMMC still see a lot of people coming in very late because A, either they don't know about HIV/AIDS, hard to believe in 2022, but that still sometimes happens, or for fear or shame or of coming forward. And so, yeah, they're just some examples.
Yep. And where you say it depends on where you are as well, I think we saw the problem of inequity rearing its head during COVID-19. And we're seeing it now with monkeypox in terms of vaccines not reaching countries that need it the most. Mm-hmm. HIV has been suffering this long before, right?
Yeah. So like I alluded to at the beginning, effective treatment was discovered around 1998, and the West, patients in the West were able to realize this. In Malaysia at that time, I recall some of my patients who could afford to pay 2,500 ringgit a month were able to have this life-saving treatment. But those, until we managed to do the voluntary licensing and get government to give free treatment. But there was a delay. It was only the AIDS conference in Durban where the world sort of stood up to this inequity that finally the WHO 3x5 program was created around 2003, if I'm not mistaken. So there was something like 5-year delay. So we saw that again with the COVID-19 vaccine, and in a way, we're seeing it with a new drug that has been formulated, which is called the long-acting cabotegravir, that is going to be very, very effective to prevent HIV. So in the past, PrEP is taking one pill a day, but long-acting cabotegravir could mean that you only need an injection every 2 months. So 6 injections a year could prevent, HIV infection as effectively as more than 90%, right? So once again, the debate is how soon can we get it into, the bums of people to prevent HIV in lower middle income countries where it's needed most. So one of the proud things that we as the International AIDS Society did was leading to the conference was, of course, we don't take full credit for it, but we also initiated discussions with Viv and Medicines Patent Pool and there were also other organizations that come together to advocate to ensure that this treatment or this prevention and treatment, it can also be used for treatment, will be available to low and middle income countries about the same time that it's available in rich countries. So Viv and Medicine Patent Pool have signed an agreement for voluntary licensing to 3 generic companies to provide this to about 99 countries in sub-Saharan Africa and others with high prevalence and depending on GDP as well. So Malaysia will probably be able to see this by 2027, be able to access this. They're starting off with countries in Africa first. So that in a way is quite an exciting news because at the conference, the investigators discussed the 1-year result. So it's a very, very new modality drug. And to be able to already discuss how we can roll this out and have agreements whilst the studies are still ongoing, I think this is the way forward, whether it's for HIV, whether it's for future COVID-19 treatment or vaccines or the next monkeypox vaccine, whatever, that, drug companies, when they invent new drugs or vaccine, there must be discussions on how to have, equal access to the whole world. As part of that, what the IAS is doing, the International AIDS Society is doing, we have a program on HIV cure as well as vaccine. And are having discussions to address just this. Like, you can't wait to until the time when you find a cure or an HIV vaccine to then figure out, now, how do we get this to countries where it's needed most? So there's quite a lot of interesting discussions around how to prepare for all this to happen.
Absolutely.
Which will help other diseases as well. I mean, you know, one of the exciting advances in medicine is all these biologics and other things for treatment of cancer, right? And that is just completely unaffordable in most places. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, the same, what you're saying is the same frameworks, the same mechanisms that we can replicate for many, many diseases and for the discussions and for the discussions to be happening in tandem with the development and trials.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society, about the world's progress when it comes to ending AIDS and Malaysia as well. She's been highlighting some of the findings from the 24th International AIDS Conference, as well as from UNAIDS Global AIDS Update 2022 report. We'll come back from the break to just catch up a little bit more about looking forward, and most of the conversation has been about that, what we need to keep our eye on. But a little bit, I think, about, you know, what keeps the what keeps people like Prof. Adiba going, you know, so that we don't take our foot off the pedal. Do call us if you have any questions or thoughts, 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-ik. I'm joined by Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society and also infectious diseases physician at University Malaya Medical Center. We've been discussing, and I want to read this message from a listener who is reflecting on the figures you shared earlier, Prof. Adiba. The target was to have only 500,000 new infections in 2021. In reality, it was three times that number. What has gone wrong? That's what we've been discussing. What has gone wrong and what we need to keep our eye on. I think it was from the International AIDS Conference recently in Montreal that that Anthony Fauci, who, of course, has been very prominent in the COVID-19 pandemic, said it's a tough sell to keep the enthusiasm up when it comes to tackling HIV. And I'm wondering, Prof, how do you keep your enthusiasm up as well? And how do you continue to advocate for and to push to dismantle all those structural and social barriers that you talked about earlier?
Yeah, I think it's on several levels. Admittedly, I have not had much time to do clinical work in the last year or two, but ultimately it's the patients that drive us, that drive all of us, you know. Seeing those who come in very ill and get better, it's what we do, right? It's what drives us every day, and to be able to prevent young people from this horrible disease is it's something I think that drives all of us. So that's at the doctor-patient individual level. At the bigger picture level, I think all these signs that we see in HIV/AIDS is just so exciting, right? You know, I trained in the days when people were literally dying, patients were literally dying all around me, and now to see, you know, a completely different disease. But we keep moving forward. We keep seeing, we keep getting new treatment modalities that gets better and better, new. So the just the science of it, I think, is very exciting. Not to mention we're edging closer to a cure or perhaps even a vaccine. You know, there were two new patients cured announced in Montreal as well. So I think being part of this movement is to me is very exciting. And of course, like what I mentioned earlier, HIV/AIDS is so different. It's, you know, when I go to the conference, it's not just seeing other doctors and other scientists, it's seeing the whole gamut of humanity, you know, and really, really people who are meeting people who are absolutely passionate about what they do, and it's very infectious. Like what I said in my closing speech at the conference, you know, I felt rejuvenated, I felt inspired by three things. One was, of course, at the country level, by countries like Botswana and Rwanda, which is not only eliminating HIV, or not only, you know, are able to reach the targets, but also it's coming close to eliminating hepatitis C virus. So if Botswana and Rwanda can, so can we, right? So that kind of motivates me. And then I met colleagues from the Alliance of Public Health in Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine in the middle of a war, right? They are delivering services for people, particularly for people who inject drugs. And what my colleague, Andrea, who's on the governing council of IAS, told us in this media roundtable we had, that they continue to provide services initially with using mobile vans. And then when they ran out of petrol, they started using bicycles. And when their bicycles went missing, they went on foot. You know, I mean, these are the kinds of stories and commitment that, you know, really humbles you and inspires you at the same time. And I also met, you know, this young doctor from Pakistan who is a transgender who used to work as a sex worker to you know, kind of fund herself. And is now a doctor advocating for trans rights. And similarly, I met a trans doctor from Jakarta who must live through very, very difficult you know, circumstances to get where they are. And two other people I met who really inspired me were these youth leaders that the IAS support. One young man from Uganda who was perinatally infected and now also is a doctor, you know, having four other siblings who are living with HIV and was orphaned, and, you know, grandma died when they were, you know, the stories, you know, how did these people survive and come to where they are? So those are the moments that you think, yeah, you know, we have to keep going, because there are all these other thousands of people, you know, working for the same cause and giving their all for it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like you said, I think this is the only discipline or area where you would see such... And I saw pictures coming out of
energy,
the conference.
Yeah.
Yeah, so colourful, so energetic, so real.
Yeah, we had, I don't know, I think we had 4 or 5 protests. I mean, as the chair of the conference, it was a bit... you know,
stressful.
It was a bit stressful, but, you know, the IAS team is very, and the security team sort of know what to do. And it added to, I think, the re-engagement and the re-energizing the movement.
What I'm also getting from you is those stories of people living with HIV who've come through such trials to get to where they are and continuing the fight for others who perhaps don't have that voice yet. And I just wanted to hear from you, because when I was growing up, certainly the message around HIV and AIDS was one of fear, you know, accompanied by visuals and messages of death and things like that, right? But today, should anyone still be afraid of a HIV diagnosis or be afraid of anyone who has HIV?
And the quick answer is no, right? Because treatment is so effective, like I said earlier, that particularly if given early, someone living with HIV will not develop AIDS and can continue to live a healthy, productive life and have a normal lifespan. So that's number one. And number two, if they continue to, and now the pill is only one pill a day, and if they reach the undetectable viral levels, they will not, in the case of a woman, transmit it to their baby, so they can have normal pregnancies. In the case of a woman or a man, they don't transmit it to their sexual partners, even without condoms, in this concept known as undetectable equals untransmissible. You equals you. So there really is nothing to fear. But of course, you don't want to get it in the first place, right? Because otherwise, you're going to be taking a pill for life, and it's not without side effects. You know, any medicine that you take for a long time will lead to problems. Yeah.
So we're talking about being able to treat it. We're talking about being able to prevent it. We've been talking about that for years. We can definitely. And those issues of inequalities and stigma and discrimination are still standing in the way. And you are, along with many, many other people within the AIDS community, fighting to dismantle those barriers. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. I have been speaking to Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society, about progress in ending AIDS and what we need to keep our eye on looking towards the target of ending AIDS by 2030. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.